no objection, we'll let the show begin. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and thank you very much for coming to this auditorium today. Let me introduce myself. I'm Bob Oakes from Morning Edition on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure some of you are saying, wow, that's Bob Oakes? I thought he was taller. I thought he was thinner. I thought he had more hair. And you know, the funny thing is that all those things were true last week. Let me thank all of you for coming here this afternoon and thank the Boston Book Festival for having us. Don't they do a nice job? Isn't this a terrific event?
Yes.
Let's also thank the Plymouth Rock Foundation for sponsoring this particular session and say that without their generosity, it would be hard to put on events like this that add to the cultural life that we all enjoy in this great city. So thanks to them. And in a way, that's what we're here to talk about this afternoon, the triumph of this city and all the city, the triumph of the city. That's the title of Harvard economics professor Ed Glaser's book. It's about what's made cities around the world great, about the challenges that they have had to overcome and still face. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes in the special context of this city with our panel, and we'll take questions from you as well later. But first, to launch us off with a presentation, here's the author, Professor Ed Glaser.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob, and thank you all so much for being here. I'm so enormously flattered that you've decided to take time out of your Saturday afternoon to come and talk about cities. I'm also particularly grateful to the Boston Book Festival for including this book. I mean, I think every single one of you loves books, and I'm just thrilled to be part of this amazing thing that goes on here. Well, let me start with a portrait of America. And I call it a portrait to make it really clear from the very start that I have absolutely no aesthetic sense whatsoever. But this is a sort of a portrait. I've taken the 3,000-odd counties in this country, and I've split them into tenths. Each dot represents roughly 300 counties on the basis of their density levels. Because at their heart, cities are the absence of physical space between people. Cities are proximity, density, closeness. The bottom line shows the relationship between density and incomes. As you can see, there's a steadily increasing relationship there, where the densest tenth of America's counties earn on average, on a per capita basis, 50% more than the people living in the least dense half of America's counties. This is a common phenomenon in the United States and throughout the world. The three largest metropolitan areas in this country produce 18% of our nation's GDP, almost a fifth, while including only 13% of America's population. The top line shows something that may be somewhat more surprising. It's the relationship between population growth between the years 2000 and 2010 and initial population density. And as you can see, until you get to the very top tenth, population growth goes up steadily with density. At the start of the 19th century, we were leaving our dense enclaves on the eastern seaboard to spread out to take advantage of the enormous wealth of the American hinterland. At the start of the 21st century, instead of spreading out, we're clustering in. We're clamoring to be close to one another. Now, we see in Boston the resurgence of a great city. We see in New York, in San Francisco, in Seattle, in Chicago, all of these places, in London and Paris, we see the triumph of the developed world cities. But the success of the city in the developed world is nothing relative to what's happening in the developing world. We've recently reached that halfway point where more than half of humanity now lives in urbanized areas. And it's hard not to think that on net, that's a good thing, because when you compare those countries that are more than 50% urbanized to those countries that are less than 50% urbanized, the more urbanized countries have, on average, income levels that are five times higher and infant mortality levels that are less than a third. Gandhi famously said, "The future of the nation, the growth of the nation, depends not on its cities, but on its villages." But with all due respect to the great man, on this one, he was completely and utterly wrong. Because, in fact, the future of India is not made in villages which too often remain mired in the unending rural poverty that has plagued most of humanity throughout almost all of its existence. It is the cities. It is Bangalore, it is Kolkata, it is Mumbai, it is Delhi, it is Gargaon that are the places that are the pathways out of poverty into prosperity. They are the places that are the conduits, the channels across civilizations and continents, and they're the place where India is transforming itself from a place that was practically a synonym for poverty and deprivation to a place that is bubbling with opportunity. Now, in some sense, the success of cities in the modern age is something of a paradox. We live in an age in which distance is dead, in which every single one of us could just telecommute in to whatever, you know, whatever business employs us, occupying, living in whatever sylvan spot appeals to our biophilia. And yet in so many ways, in so many cases, we choose urban life. We choose the inconveniences, the high cost of living in urban areas, despite the fact that the techno-prophets and the cyberseers 20 years ago predicted that all this new technology would make cities obsolete. And yet, Google, which of all the companies in the world should have access to the best long-distance working technology, what do? They build the Googleplex so their workers can be right next to one another. Silicon Valley, right? Practically the most famous geographic cluster in the world is also the industry which is the most technologically savvy. Why is it that all of this new technology, far from making face-to-face contact in the cities that enable it obsolete, seems to be hypercharging our cities? Now, this relatively rosy view of cities is very unlike the New York of my youth. I was born in Manhattan in 1967. I say that warily in the Boston Public Library. But I was. And these are two iconic images from my youth. We could have similar images of New York, of Boston in the 1970s as well. The bottom image is of Gerald Ford denying New York's request for a fiscal bailout. Ford didn't literally tell New York to drop dead, but lots of people think he meant it. And indeed, it looked as if New York was very much headed for the trash heap of history. The city had been hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs by the hundreds of thousands in the 1960s and early 70s. The largest industrial cluster in the U.S. in the 1950s was not automobile production in Detroit. It was garment production in New York City, and that sector was decimated by globalization and new technologies. The city had been caught in a spiral of disorder, rising crime rates, racial conflict, just like here in Boston, and the fiscal situation had gotten out of control with budgets that were far too high for the city to afford. It looked as if New York was going to go back to the weeds, right? This is an image of Jimmy Carter wandering through the wasteland that the South Bronx had become, and it really seemed as if the Planet of the Apes image of the Statue of Liberty rising from the sand, that was plausible. That in fact these cities were things that had, you know, whose time had come and gone. In part, the future of the city seemed so dim because their original reason for being had largely disappeared. If you think about every one of America's older, colder cities, they were all part of solving a transportation problem. They were all nodes on a transportation network. If you go back to 1816, we as Americans sat on the edge of an enormously wealthy continent that was virtually inaccessible. In 1816, it cost as much to move goods 30 miles over land as it did to ship them across the entire Atlantic Ocean. It was so expensive to get goods in. Over the course of the 19th century, we built an amazing network. We built canals like the Erie and Illinois and Michigan Canal. We built railroads that supplemented the canals. And cities grew up at pinch points on that network, at Buffalo, the western terminus of the Erie Canal. The oldest cities were typically where the river meets the sea, like Boston and New York. But every one of America's 20 largest cities in 1900 was on a major waterway. Chicago was a city whose future was made by two canals, Erie and Illinois and Michigan, that made it the linchpin of a watery arc that went all the way from New York to New Orleans. And industries grew up around these transportation hubs. Chicago's most famous industry is, of course, its stockyards, and that's what you're looking at right now. Right? Those stockyards were part of the problem of getting the corn that America grows so well then and now, and it would even without utterly benighted agricultural policies followed by the federal government with subsidizing corn. That was a completely unnecessary aside. I apologize for that. But we would be very, very good at growing corn with or without those subsidies. The problem was getting it to market. Originally, it was moved over vast distances in that very portable, highly durable, and quite tasty form of whiskey. We then moved to pigs, which are, of course, corn with feet. which were able to be salted for some reason or other. Human beings have always preferred salted pork to salted beef. And then once this character, Armor, figures out about refrigerated rail cars, the key innovation being you put the blocks of ice on top rather than below the dressed beef so that cold water drips down, keeping the beef cold during the shift, you're able to have a single great stockyard in Chicago, which is moving those corn-fed beef in a cost-efficient manner east. Now, even though cities form for utterly prosaic reasons, miracles happen when smart people come to being around each other, when they innovate near one another, when they learn from one another. Think about Athens 2,500 years ago, or think about Florence 600 years ago in the age of the Medici, where a city built on wool and banking, but a city that connected brilliant people who learned from one another and created a chain of collaborative genius. Brunelleschi figures out the basic mathematics of linear perspective. He passes it along to his friend Donatello, who puts it in low relief sculpture on the wall of Orson Kelly, who passes it along to Masaccio, who puts it in a painting in the Brancacci Chapel, that beautiful image of St. Peter finding a silver coin in the belly of a fish, who passes it along to his friend and student, that less than saintly monk, Fra Filippo Lippi, who passes it along to Botticelli and so forth, a chain of genius, each person borrowing from one another. And so it was in Chicago, where they collaboratively invented the skyscraper in the age of Armor and his stockyards. And so it was in Detroit, when they collaboratively invented the mass-produced car. It's not just about this character, Ford, who came to Detroit, a classic inland port, Detroit, working at Detroit Dry Dock, a cutting-edge engine company that provided him with the skills that he needed to become an engine innovator. Cities, then as now, are forges of human capital. It wasn't just about Ford. It was about the Dodge brothers, the Fisher brothers, David Dunbar, Buick, Billy Durant, Ransom E. Olds, and Charles Kirby. Collectively, they managed to produce mass-produced automobiles. In the short run, this was a great thing, right? But in the long run, it was a disaster. Successful cities at the dawn of the 21st century look a lot like successful cities 200 years ago. They're marked by having small firms, smart people, and connections to the outside world. Right. How far away from this is the Rouge, Ford's great factory, vertically integrated, walled off from the outside world, employing tens of thousands of less educated workers? A wonderful recipe for short-run productivity, a wonderful recipe for paying workers $5 a day that they never could have experienced anywhere else. It was factories like this that made Detroit quite possibly the most productive place in the planet in 1950. But these factories were not a recipe for long-run urban regeneration, not a recipe for success, because they don't need the city, they don't give to the city. They're a world unto themselves. They follow their own very strong internal calculus of cost minimization, and when conditions change, and they always change, you just move the factories to places where it's cheaper. You have nothing left. And so as transportation costs declined, we moved these factories to lower-cost locales, we moved them to the suburbs, we moved them to the right-to-work states, and we moved them across the country. Now, Detroit still has not recovered from deindustrialization. In part, Detroit had really the worst of all possible worlds. It had a single large industry, a few dominant firms. Those firms had crowded out all local entrepreneurship. And the city has had a significant degree of problems ever since. They lost 25% of their population between 2000 and 2010. Luckily, not all cities followed this path. We all know, many of us know the story of Boston's regeneration, transformation from an old industrial textile and others town to a capital of the information age. But it's easy to forget that Seattle, 40 years ago, two real estate jokers put up a sign on the highways leaving Seattle asking the last person to leave the city to please turn out the lights. Because Seattle's future seemed so dim, because Boeing was cutting back on its jobs. No one could imagine a Seattle without Boeing, just like no one could imagine a Detroit without General Motors. This is before Amazon, before Costco, before Microsoft and Starbucks is at most the faint whiff of an aroma in a coffee roaster's nostrils. Right? Seattle came back. It came back because of skills and entrepreneurship, just like Boston. These are two of the people who played an outsized role in Boston's rebirth as a capital of ideas. That's Vannevar Bush, MIT scientist, founder of Raytheon, advisor to presidents, a man who very much was a statesman who moved the academy into the world of commerce. He was an entrepreneur, and he was indeed the mentor of Fred Terman, who would go on to be the father of Silicon Valley on the other side of the country. The other image is, I couldn't get a non-copyright picture of Arthur D. Little, so that's Arthur D. Little Hall at MIT. Arthur D. Little was an MIT chemist who started the management consulting industry in Boston. And Little he was an academic who then went on to, say, start up the research lab for General Motors. Now, one variable does better than any other in explaining which older, colder cities came back, and that's skills. The share of the population with a college degree as of 1960 or 1970 does an incredible job of explaining which older, colder cities came back. This is the past 10 years. I've ranked counties on the basis of skills from the least skilled to the most. As you can see, there's a whopping difference in terms of population growth over the last 10 years in this. If you want to understand why Seattle and Detroit look very different, you don't need to look much further than 12% of Detroit's adults have college degrees, while over 50% of Seattle's do. As the share of the population in a metropolitan area with a college degree goes up by 10%, your wages go up on average by 8%, holding your own years of schooling constant. It's just that valuable to be around skilled people. Now, the role of skills in explaining why cities come back helps us make sense of the paradox with which I began this talk. The connection between skills and city growth reflects the fact that the great urban advantage in the world today is to facilitate the flow of knowledge. For what globalization and new technologies have done is they've increased the returns to being smart. They've increased the returns to innovation because you can sell it on the other side of the planet. You can buy it on the other side of the planet. You're competing in a global marketplace full of opportunity if you're smart enough to see it. They've also increased the complexity of the world. And the more complicated the idea is, the more likely it is to be lost in translation. Right? Anyone who's ever taught knows the hard thing about teaching is not knowing your script. It's knowing whether anything you're saying is getting through. And whether or not, you know, and when you're in the same room, you can take advantage of those wonderful cues that we have evolved over millions of years for communicating comprehension or confusion. In some sense, cities are so valuable because they take advantage of humanity's greatest asset, which is our ability, which we have when we come out of the womb, to just soak up information from our parents, from our peers, from our siblings, even occasionally from our teachers. Cities make that happen. They enable us to be smart, to become smart, by being around other smart people. And that's why Google builds the Googleplex. That's why Silicon Valley exists, and that's why Boston has come back. That globalization, new technologies have made it important to be smart, and this is a city where we can come and be smart by learning from the mistakes and successes of people around us. Now, the most important skills that happen in city, the most important ideas that happen in city, are not, in fact, the skills that are taught in colleges, although those are clearly helpful. They're the skills that are learned afterwards on the city streets. And there's no skill or talent that's more crucial for urban success than entrepreneurship, the inclinations, the abilities to be an entrepreneur. And measures of entrepreneurship, like the share of employment in startups or like the average establishment size, are very good predictors, meaning small establishments mean more growth of subsequent success. 50 years ago, the economist Ben Chinitz compared New York and Pittsburgh and noted that New York was more resilient even then. And he argued that this was a result of the historic concentration in the garment sector, which was a mother of entrepreneurship because it was so easy for anybody with a good idea to get started. All you needed was a couple of sewing machines. By contrast, Pittsburgh had U.S. Steel, like General Motors, a fantastically efficient company in the short run, but not a place that trained entrepreneurs. It trained company men. These guys, the middle managers in U.S. Steel, like the middle managers at General Motors, would not know how to start an electronic greeting card company if GM went down or U.S. Steel went down. But those garment guys, they would, because their whole life had been trying to find opportunity. And indeed, my book is full of, tells the story of A.E. Lefcourt, who built more new skyscrapers than any other New Yorker did in the 1920s. He got his start as a garment in the garment district. Lefcourt, like many developers, also showed a certain strain towards irrational exuberance. He declared that he was certain that 1930 would be the greatest of all building years. He died poor. Now, of course, not everything about cities is rosy, particularly once you leave the U.S. The same urban proximity that enables people to communicate ideas at near neighborhood to one another also enables us to communicate diseases with one another. And if you're close enough to sell someone a newspaper, you're close enough to rob them as well. Over the course of history, cities have been battling with the demons of density, crime, contagious disease, congestion. This is a map of death rates in New York from 1800 to today. A boy born in New York City could expect to live 7 years less than the national average. Today, life expectancies are 3 years longer than the national average. We don't, by the way, understand fully why cities like Boston and New York are healthier than lower density areas. Among older people, the death rates are lower. Some people credit walking. Some people credit more social connection. We have no hard statistics that prove this. Among younger people, though, it's crystal clear. Two big causes of death for the young, motor vehicle accidents and suicide, both much rarer in urban areas. It's just a lot safer to get on the T after a few drinks than it is to get behind the wheel of a car. Not that I'm recommending anything. Suicide is more of a puzzle. Why are suicide rates so low in cities? Maybe it also reflects social connection. Maybe, on the other hand, it reflects the influence of gun culture in low-density America, for there's a strong correlation between hunting licenses per capita and teen suicide rates across counties in the United States. Now, this didn't happen by accident. America's cities and towns only became safe through massive expenditures on waterworks. Right? America's cities and towns were spending as much on water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army. Unbelievable expense, triumphant engineering. But there are some urban problems, like congestion, that require more than merely an engineering solution. The problem with building more roads is that it just causes people to drive more. There's something called the fundamental law of traffic congestion, identified by Gilles Duranton and Matthew Turner, that establishes that vehicle miles traveled increase roughly one for one with highway miles built. If you build it, they will drive. Okay. The only way to make sure that our city streets are used efficiently is to charge people for it, is to actually do what Singapore does, second densest country in the world, and yet you can drive around it effortlessly during prime hours because they have that electronic road pricing thing that actually charges you for using these streets. America's cities are running essentially a Soviet-style urban transit policy. And by this I mean that in the old Soviet Union, they used to have grocery stores that would give away eggs and butter at far below market prices. The result was long lines and stockouts. You couldn't get the goods. That's what we do with our city streets. We give access away to them for free. They're a valuable commodity. As a result, they're the urban equivalent of long lines and stockouts, which are traffic jams, which are streets that cannot be traveled along. There's no path other than actually making people pay for the cost of their actions. Now, we already, of course, pay plenty, and one of the enduring challenges of cities is how to make them affordable. I know of no way to solve this other than building, other than providing more supply. For indeed, there's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. This is actually where Jane Jacobs, who is a peerless observer of urban life, got it wrong, for she looked at old buildings and new buildings and noted that old buildings were cheap while new buildings were expensive, which led her to conclude that the right way to preserve urban affordability was to make sure that no one built any new buildings on top of old buildings. Now, that isn't how supply and demand works. You don't need to look any further than her own historic preservation district of Greenwich Village, which she worked so hard to create, to see the impact of freezing a city in amber. Her home district, which was affordable when she and her husband lived there in the 1950s, has turned into a place that is where townhouses start at $5 million a pop and only hedge fund managers need apply. That's what happens when you turn off the chain of building new housing. Now, one of the reasons why it's so important to nurture our cities, and indeed allowing more building is one of the ways that we can enable our cities to grow, is the environment. And I'm going to end by telling a story of a young Harvard College graduate who, on a beautiful spring day in 1844, went for a walk in the woods outside of Concord. And he did a little fishing, and the fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And then he came to cook the fish into a chowder. It is about Boston, after all. And the wind came and flicked the flames that he was using to nearby dry grass, and a fire started, and it spread, and it spread. And eventually it turned into a raging inferno which burned down more than 300 acres of prime woodland. In his own day, this young man was castigated as an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman called him a flibbertigibbet, which I think was pretty bad for 1844. And indeed, it's hard not to see that they were right, because I can't think of any young man living in Boston or Cambridge who did as much damage to the environment as this young man did. Of course, he is Henry David Thoreau, now revered as the secular saint of American environmentalism, whose book Walden seems to preach a gospel of what a wonderful thing it is to live surrounded by nature. But his own life tells a very different story. His own life preaches the moral that we are a destructive species, and if you love nature, stay away from it, as indeed Thoreau would have done nature a wonderful degree of good if he had stayed home in Cambridge instead of lighting fires in the middle of the woods outside of Concord. Now, there is a modern equivalent of this, which is that when people, and I need to make it clear, I know about this, is that when I started acquiring small children about 7 years ago. Only economists talk about acquiring small children. I too, moved to an area not far away from where Thoreau lived, and I started doing almost as much damage to the environment as Thoreau did. And the reason why people in suburbs tend to do significantly more environmental damage is much longer car drives, and much larger housing units. One way of thinking about this is if the great growing economies of India and China see their per capita carbon emission levels rise to those seen in the sprawling United States, global carbon emissions go up by about 130%. If they stop at the level of wealthy but hyper-dense Hong Kong, global carbon emissions go up by less than 30%. That's a huge difference. And whether or not you believe in global warming or you're just worried about the price of gas at the pump, we all have a lot to gain by China and India building up rather than out. And I think the most important thing for America to do in order to encourage that to happen is to get its own urban policies in order. And that means stop treating our cities as if they are the ugly stepchildren of America and recognize them for the economic heartland, the intellectual heartland, the cultural heartland of this country. And to me, that means rethinking policies that act as if the American dream can only mean being a homeowner in the suburb. It means rethinking policies that pay for highways with general tax revenues, essentially bribing people to drive longer distances, focusing above all on our city schools, which are such a critical ingredient for urban success and such a critical problem, which despite enormously hard work by people like Mayor Menino, like the city council, like leaders throughout this country, are still so far from what they should be. And of course, finally, allowing enough buildings so that every young couple that wants to live in a city can actually afford it. But I don't want to end on something bleak. I think the basic line is, despite the challenges this world faces, the track record of our species, when we work together, when we learn from one another, when we are powered by our cities, is just tremendous. And I have every piece of optimistic belief that cities will continue to power humanity's future and create marvelous things for centuries, if not millennia, to come. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ed Glaser, I think what we just learned in the last few minutes, in addition to learning a lot more about how our cities developed, is that no one sleeps in Ed Glaser's classes at Harvard. And by the way, he'll be signing books in the lobby of the auditorium up above once we're done. Let me introduce our panel. In addition to Ed, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley.
Good afternoon. Hi, everyone. Good to see you.
And senior advisor to Mayor Menino, Barbara Burke. Barbara, good afternoon.
Yep.
And I want you to take us, let me start this way. I want you to take us a little further back, because in the book you say that Boston's rebirth has as much to do with recent politics as what happened in the 1630s.
Hmm.
Explain.
So if we think about where Boston, how Boston came back, it's hard not to place an outsized role for the education that this city has always invested in. And indeed, you know, we have the examples of Vannevar Bush above, and he's an example of one of the people who brought the academy into entrepreneurship. Now, Boston's path towards education didn't start with MIT, although MIT is an example of the land-grant colleges that have a remarkable correlation, according to the work of Enrico Moretti, between land-grant colleges and the subsequent success of different metropolitan areas in the country. MIT is our land-grant college. But if you think about Boston's turn towards education, it didn't happen in the 19th century. It didn't happen in the 18th century. It happened when the first Bostonians, almost 400 years ago, came here and decided to create the Boston Latin School and then use state funding to create Harvard. These were investments that then set the course for years afterwards. I mean, I often think of it that you really need to just have, you know, a vastly high degree of education to possibly believe that crossing the Atlantic to be able to be with people who think that dancing is a sin is a great idea, right? That you really need to be highly educated to think that that's a swell idea. And if you think back, the roots of our educational investment aren't always so attractive. It's nice to think that we thought that, you know, Harvard was a great institution, but we were very worried about, you know, the Jesuits, you know, leading the kingdom of the Antichrist, I think was a word that was often used to describe the fears of Jesuit education in the New World. So we were, you know, part of this deeply deeply religiously fractious world, and our universities and our schools were seen as being a critical investment in that. It worked out for the best, of course, but its roots go back to the religious fractures of the early 17th century.
So if Boston's if Boston as a center of higher education continues to bear fruit for us, continues to reward us, Does the mere presence, Ayanna, let me ask you this question. Does the mere presence of Harvard, Northeastern, Tufts, BC, BU, and all the rest guarantee, do you think, that we stay that way in the future?
There are certainly never any guarantees. I always believe that the best economic development strategy is to attract and train smart people and then more or less get out of their way. So that's basically what the best thing that we can do. It's still no guarantee, but we face significant challenges, which is there's just an incredible river of talent that runs through our schools. It's hard convincing them to stay in Boston.
Right.
A couple of years ago, at the behest of Ayanna's colleague, Mike Ross, I chaired this Boston Citizens Committee for the Future of Boston, and I spent a lot of time having conversation with 20-somethings about what they thought was troubling about Boston and why they wanted to leave. Right. A lot of them objected to high prices and said, look, if I'm going to pay this much for an apartment, I can go to New York and have a better nightlife. A lot of them were complaining about the T not running after midnight, which was news to me as with three small children, I hadn't seen the Far Side at 10 p.m. for a very long time. I was not aware that the T stopped it at midnight. And part of it, of course, is just how open the city is to entrepreneurship, to new startups. And that's certainly something that the mayor with the Innovation District has been very focused on trying to make Boston be more startup friendly. But I mentioned earlier that having a lot of little establishments is an indicator of both entrepreneurship and subsequent success. Suffolk County is terrible on this measure, right? And it's not just an issue of a few industries like healthcare. This is not a county that traditionally has had lots of small startups. It's been dominated by large scale, often older employers. This is something that's a big challenge. And I'm thrilled that the mayor is now concentrating on it, but we've got to make sure that the river of talent stays here and then is free and empowered to make valuable changes.
Ayanna wants to weigh in.
Yes. recently was at the Democratic National Convention, and James Carville reminded me there that with all the talk about the economy, that we don't live in an economy, we live in a society. And I care deeply about the kind of society that we are creating. And I use the word creating on purpose. Today, community does not happen organically. We have to be very intentional and deliberate about that. And while the city council is currently in the midst of a school reassignment process, I've learned that quality is subjective, the definition of that. While the city council is in the midst of a redistricting process, I've learned that community is subjective and how neighborhood is defined. So I do believe in investing in infrastructure and all those things that would eradicate or mitigate a brain drain. But ultimately, I believe that it doesn't matter if we have more affordable housing or better jobs or better schools if people don't want to live here. And that has everything to do with community and the soul of a city. People want to be a part of a city that is diverse and inclusive and welcoming. Neighborhood is about social interaction. And that's really how we build community. And in a city like Boston that has 22 distinct neighborhoods, which I'm very proud to represent them as one of four at-large Boston city councilors, we have to be very intentional about how we foster those social interactions. And I think that we will be giving short shrift to these larger sort of macro issues if we didn't speak about what's really at the heart of it. And you want people to want to be a part of a community. And the last thing I would say, at least for now, is that I studied Latin when I was in school, and I was recently spending time with a linguist who was remarking that both young people and adults are often referring to where they reside as their hood, that we have all but taken out of the word neighbor, and how critical it is that we start to put that back in our language and what impact that might have.
Barbara Burke.
Well, I was going to build on that point of what neighbors do for the hood, because community has changed a lot. It used to be when people came to a community, even when immigrants came to a community, they came to a tight, small community. There were faith-based communities. There were schools where everyone in the school was integrated around serving the child and the parent and finding clothing and services. Everybody in the community was lifting everyone else up. And we went through a period of evolution of a lot of our cities where they became very fragmented.
Indeed.
Because of some of the burdens that Ed describes in his book. We had a flight of the people who created those structures that lifted people. But the message in his book is that cities still do that, but we need to be more conscious of how we do that, how we rebuild that lifting infrastructure. And when you attract young people and people with dreams, when you attract immigrants, as you pointed out, when you attract entrepreneurs, as we're trying to do with the Innovation District and all of the other ways we attract entrepreneurs, even the way we try and attract our empty nesters, people who come back with their work and their time and their encore careers and their volunteer time, all of these people's dreams for interesting and better futures create lift, and that creates momentum, and that brings people in to the system. But what actually gives me hope, your book had one of the saddest sentences I have read in a book in a long time. I grew up in Cleveland. I actually realized I was pretty old when you said you were born in 67.
Really?
Did you 67? Say that?
Yeah, 67.
Wow.
in 1967, I was 12. And my dad used to give me $2 and say, go to downtown Cleveland. It cost a quarter to take the train downtown. You could get lunch. I mean, I feel really old. But he was a photojournalist. He said, live and see a city. See the infrastructure of a city. I grew up in a city that was dying, where jobs had left, infrastructure had left, community had left. But look at what's going on. And people were leaving those cities in the Midwest. And where are they going? All of these young people. This is an amazing thing. He does real research. I do pajama research. I was in my pajamas last night in bed, looking up in the iPad about urban studies. So in 1991, we had 30 urban studies programs. Graduate urban studies programs in the country. Now there's 120. Young people are not only flocking to cities, they're flocking to the study of cities. And that's going to give us something very interesting. These are the urban mechanics who are understanding the mechanisms that cities use to lift people.
Well, let me stop you there and talk about how we keep these people. There are an awful lot of young people in this audience, and I'm so glad you're here this afternoon. Public policymakers have been talking a lot in Boston in just the last few years about the cost of living here, talking about how the cost of housing drives people out. That might be true for young and mobile professionals, but it's not what most people talk about. Not most people, most young people talk about. If you read blogs, blogs written by young people about why they've decided to leave Boston after spending their 4+ years here, here's what they say. I've read a lot of these blogs in the last few years, and they've just almost in a way, last few days, and they've just kind of stunned me. Too small townish, not cosmopolitan, extremely cliquey and provincial. The business community is too insular and too close-knit, not enough for entertainment. And Ed, not only does the tea close early, but the bars close at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
I remember that from some long-lost days in my 20s, 20 years ago.
At first, when I read this, I kind of chuckled a little bit. But when I saw these comments repeated by the hundreds and the hundreds in the hundreds, I realized it's not amusing. We have a cultural problem here in Boston. What a majority of these young people said was 4 years plus a couple more and I'm out of here. Not one of them, not one of the comments that I read mentioned the cost of housing except to say, well, you know, you can get a better apartment in Boston for $2,000 a month than you can in New York. If the young and the innovative are the future lifeblood, the present lifeblood and the future lifeblood, then how do we address this huge cultural and lifestyle gap, which is not being addressed in this city right now?
You know, these are such a great set of comments. I think they make one critical central point, which is real cities, the real heart of the city, the real essence of the city, is not the structures and infrastructure that you see around that are so often pictured in the postcards. It's always the people. It's always about humanity. And no investment in infrastructure makes sense unless it's actually tied to the real needs of the people who are living in cities. The second point I think that's really critical in this is that the backdrop to the decline of all these older industrial cities was that transportation costs declined. It was no longer so valuable to be near the Great Lakes or near the coal mines or so forth. And what this meant was instead of having cities that were tied down by production advantages, right, like the old General Motors factories, cities could grow that were consumer cities, places where people wanted to live. That's one way of understanding why there is no variable that better predicts metropolitan area growth during the 20th century than January temperature. Above all, Americans went towards places that have warmer Januaries. Now, that is both a challenge and an opportunity, because, in fact, we only survive by attracting and retaining talent, and that's not easy. Part of it involves getting the basics of city government right. Part of it does involve affordable housing, short commutes, low crime rates, livable neighborhoods. But a lot of it is also about fun, because the reason why 20-somethings live overwhelmingly in cities is to be near other 20-somethings and to take advantage of fixed-cost things like the Boston Public Library that are fantastic urban assets. Now, I'm not going to make any particular comments about our culture here in Boston, but it is true that if there are regulations that make it difficult to innovate, it is true if there are barriers erected by various social groups that make it difficult for smart people to come up with new ideas, that means that cities lose their edge. It loses the fact that, you know, urban entrepreneurship and competition is just as good for making great restaurants and bars and clubs and everything else as it is for making cities productive. And half of it is about attracting and retaining talent, and half of it is about setting them free. And I will tell just one example from this, that is, you know, and I'm so glad that the mayor has joined the food truck fight, because it's one of my favorite crusades. I am deeply passionate about freeing the food truck, because the food truck fed me when I was a young, hungry assistant professor outside of my office building. But I was on a call about 18 months ago with a poor woman who wanted to open her food truck in Detroit, and she had been on a one-year regulatory battle to get her food truck through. Now, the idea that Detroit is saying no to any entrepreneur who wants to come into Detroit is nuts. It's just nuts, and I understand you need some health regs, but basically it's nuts. The wonderful thing, though, is that they also had the ombudsman for the city of Detroit on this public radio call, and he said, well, listen, lady, just start your food truck. We'll never catch you.
Barbara Burke,
that's
way
great.
In here.
No, I was just saying, you're reading it on blogs. I am getting that message. I have a 22-year-old daughter, Stella, just graduated from college, debated, could have picked any city, definitely wanted to live in a city. And I've been hearing train stop early, cabs are too expensive, the bars close early. I get it at my kitchen table and on texts on my mobile phone. Yet you have to explain something. Boston has the highest proportion of young adults among the nation's biggest cities. 35% of the people who live in our city are 20 to 34 years old. I mean, that's the facts. So we may have a very vocal population who are used to texting each other about how the city could be better, but not as many of them are going and leaving as you might think, and many more of them. Imagine what a magnet we are with all of the schools. I think one of the biggest questions is, we could be a much better city for longer nightlife and later hours and mixing people in a social environment in different places, but we could also be a lot better at introducing all these cities who flock to our downtown and our universities to our neighborhoods, mm-hmm. which are really phenomenal and rich and have lots going on. And, you know, so we're being successful. We could be a lot better.
Well, I think I can speak to this personally. I originally hail from Chicago, Illinois. I'm sure that will come as no surprise to people here because I'm on trend with all the other black progressive Pauls who run for office and make history. So there's...
Yes.
But I came here to attend Boston University and made a commitment to not only contribute to my campus community, but to connect to the larger city. In fact, that was why I had, well, I'll be honest, it was a good financial package too, and Harvard rejected me. And believe me, every time I lecture there, I remind them and I say, ain't this a full circle moment?
I don't say A. Anyway, that was for affect. Okay. But the point is, so I originally hail from Chicago, Illinois. I came here to attend Boston University, was a student leader and very active in my campus community, made a commitment to invest in the city as well, which was really the turning point in my life and set me on a completely different trajectory. I was president of my student body. I interned for Congressman Joseph P. Kennedy, who has since retired. He was the congressman of the 8th Congressional District. He hired me. I then went on to work for United States Senator John Kerry for 11 years, and then ultimately was recruited to run for office, was elected in 2009. I am 38. This is where you say I look much younger than that. I love coming to this space. It's good lighting. But I think, again, I can speak to this personally because now that I am an elected official, the only woman serving on that body and the first woman of color on that body in its 102-year history. And now, why does that matter and why is that relevant? I appreciate the applause. It has nothing to do with a personal achievement. I think that really is a collective and shared victory for all of us. It means that the solutions that we're developing in government are more comprehensive and more fully informed because of that different perspective. So I've thought a great deal about this issue of attraction and retention, but more than that, how do we keep native Bostonians? Because we were losing young people who had been, who were raised here, who were going someplace else. They do come back, though, I have to say that. Mm-hmm. They sort of go on this this pilgrimage to see what else is out there, but they do come back. And so to Ed's point about, and Barbara's as well, around social venues, this is an issue that I'm working on. Again, we have 22 distinctive neighborhoods, and it's very easy for us to be very siloed. And I think what young professionals are looking for and what I was looking for and found when I went outside my campus community is community and human connection. And I think restaurants are revolutionary in this way. In my home neighborhood of Dorchester, I have seen a restaurant like Ashmont Grill transform a blighted corner of Dorchester and in turn an entire neighborhood and incentivize other businesses. So restaurants are not only incredible economic anchors because they hire locally, but I think they foster community. Ashmont Grill, if you walk in there, is one of the most diverse venues you could ever patronize in the city. People are looking for community. On the development side, I'm a big believer in smart growth development. I don't own a car. So I want development that is, you're applauding. My knees and these stilettos don't like that. I love the Boston brick. I do take the T to work every morning. I'm in a smart growth development developed by Trinity Financial, the Caruth. Right in the Ashmont Adams, St. Mark's area of Dorchester. It's mixed use, retail on the first floor, mixed income as well. And we have an incredible community there. But back to the issue of restaurants before I turn it over to the next question. I'm working on the issue of liquor licenses. And I have to say that one of the reasons why our student population and our residents are in conflict is because the second someone starts talking about greater access to liquor licenses, people think you want to convert Main Street into New Orleans Bourbon Street, and that you want more bars. What I want are more social venues and an equity in that opportunity, some place that people can go and raise a glass and, you know, celebrate a christening or a graduation. And the reality is that right now we're seeing an inequity in access to those opportunities. So a neighborhood like the North End has a density of 91 liquor licenses, and a depressed neighborhood or a neighborhood that could be even more successful, like a Roxbury or Hyde Park, is having difficulty procuring those licenses. And restaurants make about 70% of their revenue on their bar. So I think restaurants can play a revolutionary role in building community and in building culture and keeping young professionals here.
Let's stay on real estate development if we can, but let's go bigger, bigger than bricks and mortar. Let's talk about steel girders and glass. Here's the premise that Ed raises in the book. Shiny new real estate, meaning big new development, may dress up a city, but it doesn't solve its underlying problems. Too many city officials think they can bring cities back with some sort of massive reconstruction project. Let's stay with our city officials. Agree or disagree with that?
Well, let me, if I can speak,
yes,
for
please.
A little bit. I completely agree with what he's saying. You cannot build your way out of a problem with a lack of competitiveness. But one of the things that I did when I was working with the state, I was part of the Romney administration, the Secretary of Economic Development, was understand that, you know, Boston is doing tremendously well economically, but if we wanted to turn around the Pioneer Valley or southeastern Massachusetts, we had to turn around the fates of Pittsfield and Springfield and New Bedford and Fall River and Lowell and Lawrence. And in order to do that, it wasn't plopping down a single courthouse. That wasn't That's going right. to fix it. It wasn't going to be building a new walled convention center that had its back to the city. That the only way you can transform a city is with a strategy that builds on the city's assets, that tightly weaves people together around our educational assets, our human assets, our community-based organizations, our old industrial assets, and some of the new skills that are spinning off of them. And until you knit those pieces together and can find the new narrative lines that come out of that, you know, that the old, you know, this is a Providence and Fall River example, the old jewelry business, those little fine skills of making costume jewelry are phenomenal skills for medical devices. Same little set of talents and molding and work. There are all sorts of talents hidden that we can build on. When you invest in those, you can grow a city. I always used to say, I mean, a lot of people like to think of economic development as attracting businesses with deals. It's my view is it's come for money, go for money. They never attach, they never stay. We've seen many bad investments. But when you line up a new job producer with a community college and a research investment in the local university, and you begin to find the scholarships and the co-ops and the whole ladder that lifts that sector of the economy, that's the way you move from one place to another. And I mean, I'm really proud about what this state is doing. We have lots of people figuring out how to do this. Mass Inc. has just launched the Gateway Cities work. We have all the work at Northeastern on the rebirth of older industrial cities. We have this terrific book that Ed has written that is beginning to show us the ladders. He's doing something else really interesting. We have the Rappaport Scholars. We are, and all of our universities in Boston and in Massachusetts are tilting towards our cities, are lending their research, their insight, their vision, their bright young people towards engaging at the front line in lifting the city. And so we here, I think, are in a particularly interesting place. And especially when we have a mayor like Menino in front of us who's been, you know, he was faulted for being an urban mechanic, constantly working on the basic city services. But people forget that it was always about people and that these structures he's building are these ladders of human development. The acceleration agenda that Boston Public Schools has built and attaching it at the low end with the new Thrive in 5 early childhood strategy and the Success Boston strategy and wrapping the out-of-school time strategy around this acceleration agenda. And our friend Paul Grogan, who's not here, is wrapping with all the work that he did to help organize the opportunity agenda to wrap our city's biggest funders around those pipelines. And then that urban mechanics, whether you're building that pipeline for a new Bostonian, Menino was the first mayor to build a new Bostonian whole service sector, whether you're building an innovation district and lining up your entrepreneurship ladder, whether you're building, doing the home ownership training, and who remembered the mayor's Don't Borrow Trouble campaign? We escaped a huge amount of foreclosure because we built the home ownership ladders. You know, we are doing it here. And young, talented students, you're sending us more of them, are the new urban mechanics. Some of you may be in the audience today, but that energy, that talent, that brains around energizing and engineering a community's capability to lift people, that's what we've got going on in this city. That's why this room is full.
Absolutely.
I asked the development question because I feel compelled to ask a news-oriented question. I don't know why.
Can I say one thing?
Oh, I'll get you to weigh in a second. The biggest development on the horizon for Boston is the possibility of a billion-dollar casino complex being built in East Boston at the Suffolk Downs racetrack if the developers win the Eastern Massachusetts casino license, one of the three licenses up for grabs from east to west in the state. The new State Gaming Commission, of course, has to go through its process, but most insiders you talk to think that the East Boston plan has the best chance of any to go all the way. And I'm wondering, and Ed, let me start with you here,
and then
I want to go to Wayana because she has to consider this on the city council. I'm wondering if this panel thinks that that project, if built, will prove to be a triumph of the city.
I'm relatively agnostic on casinos. I'm enough of a libertarian not to think that gambling is a great sin, and I think it's not a terrible thing. On the other hand, it's unlikely to be any sort of a wellspring of further innovation or entrepreneurship that's going to come out of the area. I think the critical issue is whether or not it's going to, you know, make sure it covers any cost to the public sector of maintaining it. But I see it as being neither a game changer nor a great evil. Although, I just don't have a strong view on it one way or the other.
I'd like to say something different. The greatest infrastructure project we have in our city right now is the work being done to restructure the school assignment plan. That is not physical infrastructure, it is human infrastructure, and it is really big. Time is now in this city for people to get behind.
I wrote my last Globe column on it. I'm happy to, I've got much stronger views on that than I do on the casinos.
Yeah, however we solve it, being able to create a stronger education system that serves people.
Let me ask Diane about the casino.
you should answer the infrastructure question, though.
Yeah. Are you giving that to me because you felt I was just clamoring to comment?
Yeah.
Well, it's no secret. I'm not a big fan of casinos. But they are coming. And the lens with which I look at these issues is in making sure there's going to be an equity and opportunity for everyone, that the entire city is benefiting. Not only in the revenue that stands to be generated, but in the jobs to build the site, in the hotels and the restaurants and the retail. I will share with you, again, not to vilify or demonize any one industry, my own personal experience is being raised by a single parent with a father who struggled with drug addiction and was in and out of jail in my life in supporting that addiction. I just personally am very conflicted about things that I see as contributing to the social ills that I work to combat every day, like human trafficking, like drug abuse, like alcohol abuse. We're speaking about
domestic violence.
Again, I don't want to, demonize or vilify any one industry, but the data does show that there are a confluence of things that contribute to these social ills. So that's what I would say about casinos. Two quick points. Your point about the schools, which ties into the question I wanted to speak to earlier. We talk about a commitment to, and I know the mayor shares this, as does our superintendent, to teach the whole child. But we're being disingenuous if we don't acknowledge that most children are not entering that school whole. They are broken. And we have to have a commitment to their socio-emotional wellness. And that's not just a moral issue. There's such a thing as socio-emotional intelligence as well. And one's ability to learn executive function and to ultimately be more competitive and better prepared for the workforce. There's such an emphasis on science, technology, engineering, and math. I would never give short shrift to that. But I would be remiss at the Boston Book Festival if I did not say that we need an A in that. Because without arts, there won't be any innovation. There won't be any innovation. So what we need is STEAM. And when it comes to our economy as well, I'm a very aggressive advocate and a believer in the creative economy. I know our mayor shares a commitment to that, and everything from public art to arts education to arts in education. When I travel, people do talk about that school across the river, Harvard, but the next school they'll ask me about is Berkeley. You know, we boast so many incredible institutions related to the creative economy, and so I can't be here amongst the tribe and not talk about the humanities and art.
I'm looking at the clock, and I see that we're actually only about 10 or 15 minutes from the end of the program, and I want to make sure that if you folks have questions you want to ask of our panel, that you get some of those questions in. Does anyone have a question that they'd like to open up with? Right there in the middle is the first person that I saw, and I think that there's a microphone for you coming down the aisle. All the way down front. All the way down front, sir. The man in the red right in the middle.
Hi, my name is Sam. I work with City Year here in Boston. I'm not sure if you're familiar.
Thank you. Woo-hoo! City Year!
So I'm glad that you touched on education. My question is, City Year focuses, obviously the headquarters are here in Boston, but they're also in 22 other cities in America, two others overseas. And my question is, are urban schools destined for failure? And what do you believe is the role of the community, of the city, of the federal government, and so on? Because it seems that, you know, this thing of urban schools struggling, it's not just a Boston thing, but like I said, we're in 22 other cities. You see it, Chicago, LA, Atlanta, and so on.
Of course not. It's not a Boston thing. And indeed, I mean, overall, the Boston public schools are doing quite well relative to the many of their urban counterparts. Although that's a statement that is, you know, laced with more of a sense of tragedy than triumph. It is. It's. I can't possibly think that the failure of urban public schools is permanent. I can't wake up that way. I can't imagine that is what we are going to doom our city children to. Forever. I believe that we are making improvements, and indeed the test score data does show that, and we will continue to make improvements. Part of the challenge that we start with, right, is that cities have an abundance of people with less means. Not because cities make people poor, but because cities attract the poor. They attract the poor with the promise of economic opportunity, with better social services, with the ability to get around without buying a car for every adult. Some of my work on this looks at what happens to poverty rates near new subway stops. When you build a subway in an area, poverty rates go up nearby. That doesn't mean that the subways are hurting the people nearby. It means the subways are doing exactly what you'd hope that they're doing, which is providing a means for people with less means to actually get around. But if cities are going to attract people with less means, it's going to make it more difficult to provide good urban education, because parents with assets, parents with an abundance of human capital, can provide things for the kids to supplement what goes on in the schools. This makes this an enormous challenge. Now, I think this involves, there are many different strategies, many of them are being tried at different ways. Unquestionably, I think the federal government has a role in this. It has a role in this because education is the best means we know of fighting inequality, of creating a juster world. Right. There's no consensus in America for large-scale redistribution among adults. But I believe this country is not so far gone that we cannot get a national consensus beyond the need that every American should have the opportunity that a decent education affords. And you need the federal government involved, because when you try to do redistribution at the local level, when you try to do anything involving giving particularly to poor people, it doesn't work. We've tried this in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the rich people just leave. The companies just leave if you try to run a local welfare state. You need to have actually a federal engagement, at least with dollars, to do this, and often pushing against. I mean, one of the great advantages of Race to the Top is it pushed up the charter school limit within this community. Now, I think in terms of actual strategies, I mean, I certainly agree with Ayanna on the arts. My father was a curator at the Museum of Modern Art, and I certainly believe in the ability of art to enrich and empower all of our lives. But there's a lot to be said for math, right? The work of Josh Goodman shows each extra year of math education received by an African-American between the 80s and 90s as a result of the Nation at Risk report upping the minimum years increased adult earnings by 8%. Okay, big payoffs to actually having quantitative skills. The other thing we know that has had effects is many charter schools have been quite successful. We have lottery results in Boston that have shown this. I'm enough of an economist to believe in competition and innovation, and the charter schools make that happen. That being said, right, we cannot forget on the public school system as a whole either, and we cannot let that go. And the most critical ingredient that we know in schools is teachers. It's all about the human capital at the teacher level. To me, public school teachers are heroes. Right, the people who go in every day and fight in often very difficult conditions to make the lives better for people who are starting with less. The work of my colleague Raj Shetty and John Friedman looks at the impact of teachers on test scores and compares it with the impact of those same teachers on earnings as adults. And even though the impact of teachers on test scores peters out over years, the impact of teachers on earnings does not. And we all have experienced this in our lives. Some teacher early on our life who changed us, who opened our eyes to something, who moved us along a way. It's exactly what cities do, right? It's exactly about this process of learning from people who are close to you. And so there's nothing that's more critical in terms of rebuilding, enriching our urban school systems, that they have A, plenty of support from the federal government in terms of resources, B, the right incentives and the freedom to get the best possible teachers that they can have and the ability to pay them well, and C, I'm enough of a believer that they should face competition from charter schools as long as those charter schools are properly regulated.
I agree with all of that. I would just also add that it really is the symbiotic partnership of many things. It's a confluence of things. I think parental engagement is incredibly important as well. And so ultimately, if we're not working on those social determinants and those non-academic barriers that complicate and put in conflict that child's ability to succeed scholastically and also in life, then this is all for naught. So I do believe all the issues we've been discussing here are a critical component to that, because you can have a good school, but if there is a depressed community around it and families that are destabilized because they are working two jobs and this, or they don't have access to adult basic education, how can they advocate for their child or navigate a school system for them? So it has to be a holistic response.
I just want to build and make one additional point that I think is an interesting one. A lot of people say because we have so many immigrants and non-English speakers, that is making it harder for our school to teach and to our schools to teach and succeed. I think you may know that about 45% of Boston Public Schools' children do not speak English at home. But what you might not know is some of the terrific research that's been done about how English language learner children are doing in Boston. And when you disaggregate them by the ones who have almost no English, they are not doing so well. When you see, though, the children that have gone through the system and have a little bit of language, they are doing equally well. When you look at the kids who've been through the system and who are former English language learners, they are outperforming the native-born children in Boston public schools. And you need to look at our valedictorians. We are graduating phenomenal kids who are dual and multilingual, and we need the opportunity structures that lift these kids up. And I think the reason that they're surpassing native-born children, if you think very carefully, these native-born children, their parents were failed by school. And in some cases, their grandparents were failed by the failure of urban public schools. And these parents do not believe or in their personal experience that schools deliver opportunity. And so until we can reach back to serve the whole family, not just the whole child.
That's right.
So we can reach back into early childhood. Can we reach back to support parenting like we are with Thrive and Five? Till we reach back with Parent University and the huge investments we're making in the city? Till we reach back with adult education? When we reach back, we're going to move forward when we get multiple generations at once. And that is what this city is doing now, because we are performing, but we have a huge way to go.
All right, we're just about out of time. Just one more question. Panelists, all the way here on your left. Go ahead, sir.
Paul Duffy from the South End, born at St. Margaret's, mother from Mattapan, father from Hyde Park, lived in Fields. Thank you. Lived in Fields Corner, Beacon Hill, and now the South End. I find that in addition to its size, which is very manageable, one of the real keys to success of Boston is the high regard that the city's government has for government. And in an era when civic engagement and government at all levels is held in low esteem, erroneously in my view, Boston stands apart and is quite successful because of that intimate involvement. No one's been to a christening in Boston in the last 10 years that Mayor Menino hasn't been to. Same with, you know, Councillor Connolly, Councillor Presley, Councillor Ross, et cetera. So those of you from outside of the city, government officials, city officials, from other cities, do you share that view?
Well, absolutely I share that view. I mean, I have enormous respect for both the city council and for the Menino administration, and I think you're absolutely right that cities need government that respects government. One way to think about this is an abundance of land hides many sins. But when people are crowded together, they need management. They need management to deal with congestion and contagious disease and urban schools and all of the issues that we are facing. Those problems don't get solved by the private sector. Those problems actually need a functioning government. And so it's always been. It's why 100 years ago we had city governments long before we had a large active national government, because it was so critical that we actually deal with the problems that Boston has faced as a natural result of its density. There's a reason why people in Boston like government more than people in Montana do. They need it more. And that's central and is not going away. And I think we are absolutely blessed in this regard. We continue to have problems like the school system that continue to need more work. But we get nowhere by vilifying our government as a whole. And indeed, we should cherish our local leaders as well as occasionally goading them to do better on things. That's absolutely part of the democratic process. But we should fundamentally be grateful for them and thankful for the sacrifices that they make. Let's save our vilification for those people who serve at the national level. I think they...
Well, and along those lines, let me ask one last question. We are 15 days away, as of today, from what has been widely called the most important presidential election of our lifetimes, given that the choice between the two men running for office is very, very different. As we're in the final days, let me ask you this last question. Do you see greater challenges facing cities, Boston in particular, under a Mitt Romney presidency as opposed to a continued Barack Obama presidency? And Ed, I'm going to start with you.
I think that the track record of the national government with cities is very, very weak. And I think that that's true under both parties, occasionally very well-meaning but weak, and occasionally not so well-meaning but weak. And I think that's the larger challenge. It's not one candidate versus the other, but how to create an urban agenda that actually makes sense. One that doesn't, and again, you know, this means pushing back on policies that mean massive spending on highways with general tax revenues. I mean, President Obama is the most urban president we've had since Teddy Roosevelt, right, in many ways. And yet, you know, we had both in the infrastructure stimulus package and then the latest June highway bill, we had a massive infusion of general tax revenues instead of gas taxes to pay for drivers. I have no idea why we are bribing people to drive long distances. I'm enough, again, of a person who believes in choice to believe that people should be free to drive in if they, you know, pay for the social costs of their actions. But we shouldn't be bribing them to do this. We shouldn't be engaging in social engineering that uses federal tax policy to massively subsidize people to move out of urban apartments to buy suburban homes, which also, by the way, subsidizes them to leverage themselves to the hilt to bet on the vicissitudes of the housing market, which also bribes them to build larger homes. I'm a homeowner myself, but I think having the current home mortgage interest deduction and the other things like Fannie and Freddie that subsidize that is crazy, right? We should slowly ratchet back the top of that by $100,000 a year. And most of all, we need to have even more commitment to urban schools. But I would like a world in which we did less subsidizing for low-density areas and had the feds have less engagement in cities overall and leave cities which are perfectly capable, if they are empowered, if they have the resources to solve their own problems. I'd much rather have that happening than having any vision that the feds are going to fix this.
Barbara, and then Ayanna gets the last word.
Well, I think, so interesting thing to remember, Race to the Top started with Bush. It's been advanced deeply by Obama. We are doing things at the national level to reduce the education disparities. Obamacare started with Romney. It was Romneycare before. And that, giving everyone access to health insurance, is, again, one of the most important things we can do in this nation to level the disparities in health and the disparities created by lack of access to health insurance. So we have bipartisan support for two of the most important things that are going to level us. I think the things that we don't do is think about where do we help the most people the fastest, thinking about per capita returns on investment. And I think our biggest weakness as a nation is community colleges, is the skill gaps that we have left open, left wide open between the industries that we're holding on to as we compete globally, and this, and how well we've done educating people to take their place in the economy. And I would hope that whatever agenda comes forward, we have an agenda that is deeply, deeply focused on adult learning, adult education, community colleges, and finding more ways for people to constructively enter the economy.
And Counselor.
Yes, I would concur with many of those points. I am grateful that I live in a state that has a governor, Deval Patrick, living in a country with President Barack Obama, I'm vigorously supporting him for all the reasons you just stated, in creating better access to both educational opportunities and healthcare, which is eliminating all those other disparities. I just think it's really important that we not obsess about the 99% or the 47% and just remember that there are people behind all those percentages, and people who have been struggling and people living in poverty. We keep talking about the shrinking middle class. Who are they joining? And so I want a president and a governor and a mayor that believes in making those critical investments in physical infrastructure and in people that supports the role that everyone has to play in the economy, including getting people in poverty on a pathway to self-sufficiency. That is just as important.
Round of applause for our panel. Boston City Councilor Ayanna Presley, Senior Advisor to Mayor Menino Barbara Burke, and Harvard Professor Ed Glaser, who wrote the book we focused on today, Triumph of the City, and Ed will be signing books in the back of the hall. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Bob.
And thank you for coming this afternoon.
Well, I feel triumphant.
Just the other day.